The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Welcome to Tech Sequences. Does the political climate and the favored geopolitical model du jour impact internet and technology development? And if so, what are the consequences? In 1999, the columnist Thomas Friedman pronounced the post-Cold War geopolitical system, symbolized by its one searing image, the Berlin Wall, dead. Instead, he declared we were in an age of globalization where we had gone from a system built around walls to a system increasingly built around networks and cooperation. Globalization, he said, has one overarching characteristic, interdependence. Not surprisingly, he deemed the one thing that characterized globalization the best was the World Wide Web. So what was happening in and around 1999? For one thing, the dot-com boom was in full swing. A year earlier, a small California-based not-for-profit was founded to coordinate a somewhat obscure but vastly important function, coordinating the domain name system, known as DNS. The DNS is often referred to as the phone book of the internet because it matches domain names with appropriate IP address numbers to quickly route requests. The not-for-profit was called the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, or ICANN, and was known for employing a model of interdependence and cooperation called the multi-stakeholder model. This was a departure from a top-down or centralized governance model familiar to state-sponsored telcos. Fast forward to today, many would argue globalization is either dead or in the early stages of demise, as evidenced by the rise of nationalism, isolationist policies, and frameworks such as Brexit. These isolationist or protectionist tendencies have manifested themselves as national censorship, such as the Great Firewall of China, or threats to balkanize or fragment the internet technically or via government control. So if the decline of globalization does impact internet and technology development, what are the consequences and how should we greet them? Our guest for today is Maria Farrell. Maria is an Irish writer and keynote speaker on technology in the future. Maria has written about politics and technology for The Guardian, Slate, The Irish Times, and recently finished a commission series for Medium on the future of democracy. Previously, she was deputy head of corporate affairs and policy officer at ICANN, based in Brussels, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C. After ICANN, Maria led communications and a government advisory project at InfoDev, the World Bank IFC program on technology and development. She also taught politics and policy on Oxford University's doctoral program in cybersecurity for 4 years. Welcome, Maria.
Thank you very much, Alexa, and thank you, Leslie, for having me on.
So, welcome.
Well, that is quite the introduction. I'm so glad, actually, you brought up Thomas Friedman and, you know, interdependence and globalization and how it was all going to be this kind of wild, shining future, and we were all going to trade with each other more and share our ideas, and most of those ideas were going to be Western ideas, and they were going to travel all around the world and make the world safer for capitalism. And obviously, we found out that that's not quite how the last 20 years have shaken out. I think I remember at that time there was some kind of factoid that went around saying no two countries that have a McDonald's have ever gone to war. I remember that being, you know, one of those things that was in the ether at that time in the late 90s of basically we're all going to get McDonald's and we're all going to, you know, have these fantastic consumption-based economies that will be ever more embedded and intertwined, and we will be just so fat and happy we'll never want to go to war again. And the internet was part of that, you know, it was part of the whole, let's get embedded with each other. And then later on, you know, in the kind of early 2000s, it was part of the whole, if you have the internet, you were just kind of automatically going to have democracy because they just go together. And you will have the Arab Spring and you will have revolutions that all happen on Twitter. And you will have bloodless regime change. And the world is just going to go on getting bigger and brighter and wiser and shinier. And suddenly it didn't. So I think one of the things that happened, or that explains well what's been going on in the last few years, is actually something one of my brothers, Henry Farrell, who's a political scientist, has written about with a colleague called Abe Newman. And they've got this whole concept of weaponized interdependence. And so they've kind of taken a look at, you know, globalization is very much there. We're very much embedded in each other's economies, the US, China, Europe, everybody else. And yet we see, you know, being more financially intertwined doesn't mean we are less likely to go to at least proxy war. And so their kind of explanation of how all of this works is basically, you know, states like particularly the US have been able to weaponize the interdependence that they have by leveraging global networks in which they're very, very dominant for their own strategic advantage and to punish enemies or to try and cramp rivals. So the example, they give two examples of these, and one is the SWIFT network for economic or for financial transactions, and how the US has very, very, you know, in a very muscular fashion, to use that international relations term, has really, really used it to punish enemies and to basically say, look, you know, the dollar is the dominant currency of the world. If you want to do any kind of financial transaction and we are having any kind of sanctions against you, you are not going to be able to be part of the global financial system. And you might be North Korea, you might be Iran, you might be just some kind of Russian banker we're not interested in at the moment, but we will freeze you out. And the other example they give is the internet, where you know, the Snowden revelations showed very clearly that the US, for all of the kind of rhetoric about freedom and liberty and, you know, all of those good things, the US was very prepared to, through the back door, leverage its control over much of the internet via dominant US companies to prosecute American foreign policy, reward friends and punish enemies. And so I think we're in a world now where, you know, with the other big powers were paying attention, and they just said, ah, okay, I see. Well, you showed us the internet is so globally important. You've also showed us you're kind of prepared to cheat and use that for your own advantage. Same with the financial system. So we're going to do what any reasonable, sensible, you know, rising power would do. And we're going to create our own networks. We're going to create our own financial networks. We're going to create our own financial allies. And damn it, we're going to create our own internet. And so it was a wholly, you know, predictable, rational response to what had been happening, and the kind of the decoupling of the rhetoric of the internet's liberatory capacity with the reality of it as another way to wield power. So I think that kind of, and that's what my, you know, brother Henry and his writing partner Abe called weaponized interdependence was, yeah, we're interdependent, but we will weaponize the bits, the nodes of that network that we want when we want to, and you can't stop us. And that's kind of where we are.
So how much of that do you think is actually conscious choice? And if it's conscious choice, is it by the same actors as you know, promoted it in the first place? Because I'm thinking in particular of the internet. I think the people that built the internet and promoted the notion that it should be global, it should be free and open access, so on and so forth, you know, they weren't trying to sell Happy Meals. We really did believe that it was important and valuable and possibly world changing. Is it a different group of people or different conscious choices, or how did we get here?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question and point, because, you know, to my mind, it is different tribes. We've got different tribes here. You know, the people and who invented and the kinds of people who sustained the internet are a very different kind of people to the people who are, let's say, working in the State Department, or, you know, designing economic sanctions, or who are, you know, or who are, you know, in the NSA or whoever it is, and, you know, vice versa. I mean, there are people who are, let's say, you know, pro-internet, in that people who understand, like, to the core of their beings, why it's so important to have a network that is, you know, that is open, that's interoperable, that has permissionless innovation, that is the same everywhere you go in the world, that, you know, allows you to do different things, to like to break up, you know, dominant players in your market, or just to, you know, to post messages about politics. I mean, so, you know, there, I think, you know, I consider myself, even though I'm not very technical, I consider myself part of that tribe. And, you know, I think probably we all are, you, Leslie, more than most of us. And yeah, that's a different group of people to the people who want to weaponize this thing. But I think if you're, you know, a member of the Chinese Communist Party, or if you're just, you know, a minister of communications in a small Gulf state, you're still looking at the internet and going, well, is this going to help me or is it going to hurt me? How can it be used against me? This is a complex world, and I need to make choices about how to acquire infrastructure that is not going to be used against my country. So, with the best will and intent, those of us who, you know, are really pro-internet people are also operating in a very, you know, realpolitik kind of world, where something that was made, that was beautiful and full of promise, and still can be, has been, you know, misused and diverted from its original purpose.
And this is hardly the first time that sort of thing has happened to a technology or to an idea or to, you know, a creation brought into the world with the best intentions and having it put to, you know, worst purposes. But as embedded as I am in trying to, you know, help the internet be all that it can be, I'd like to focus just a little bit on, you know, does it have to be this way? Are there things that we can change about it now? I appreciate that some of the current reality is because the world is changing. You know, the world, nothing in global politics now is the same as it was 20, 30 years ago when the internet was being built out. And you know, that ethos of internet as a, you know, generative platform for all kind of creativity and innovation was being developed. So, you know, are there things that we can retain from that era? Are there choices we can make, or where do we go from here?
Yeah. Oh, there. I mean, we are. You know, I kind of think the only reason to get up in the morning these days is to help sustain the bits and the modes of being of the internet that are going to be there for people who come. So, you know, Leslie, you actually. You know, when you guys contacted me about this podcast and you said, are there any particular things, you know, you've read that you want to talk about? True's God, like your work on the internet invariants is something that is absolutely canon in this household. So that's a brilliant
alignment.
No pressure at all. But, you know, I hope we're going to be able to link to it so that people who listen to this can read it. But it's
Maria, summarize that quickly for those who are not familiar with it.
Sure, exactly. So it's about, so there are short versions and long versions. The long version is 80 pages long, and I would say, like, read every word. It's basically about saying, look, in 2012, a bunch of people who helped invent the internet went back and said there are, like, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 kind of fundamental characteristics of the internet that were kind of around, either kind of inherent in the design or kind of evolved to something that was like, oh, that's a great idea. Can we see, are they still there now in 2012? And then Leslie went in 2019 and said, okay, are these things still here? And these are kind of characteristics that kind of make the internet the internet. So that distinguish it from being just like a kind of a closed intranet where, you know, you've got to obey company rules to like something global. And there's stuff like, you know, has it got global reach and integrity? So, you know, you type in irishtimes.com, you know, in Ireland, you're going to get the same result as if you type it in let's say, Colombia. Stuff like it's a general purpose network. So the whole idea of, you know, the kind of the pipes are dumb. The smart stuff is at the edges. And that allows you to basically not concentrate power into network operators. And allows everybody who's coming along to the internet to do what we call permissionless innovation. So, you know, all you have to do to connect to the internet is basically use TCP/IP. I mean, that's it. You don't have to apply to your communications ministry. You don't have to fulfill some kind of bogus security requirements, you know, and censorship and all of that. You just kind of sign up. And like there's interoperability, reusable building blocks. So that basically is kind of almost like a modular network structure, so that everybody coming to it can continue to build it out. And like, that's not just
like Legos.
Like Lego, exactly. And it's not like a utopian sort of ideal model. It's basically, you know, how people in Tanzania and Uruguay and Dublin back in the day were able to say, oh, look, there's this fantastic, weird kind of networking technology coming out of California. It's not too expensive. We can kind of figure it out and we can build it ourselves. And so it kind of, it builds itself. And so that's kind of the internet invariants. I hope, Leslie, I've given it a kind of a reasonable summary, but
definitely, and it's so heartening to know that somebody else on the planet has actually read it. Yes. I think one of the things that was really interesting in the first blush of going through and putting together the list of characteristics was, you know, as we were sitting around the table and talking about, well, what really matters about the internet, people pointedly said, not that it's the IP protocol, neither IPv4 nor IPv6. That's not actually what makes the internet. It's these other basic characteristics. And then when we went back and looked at it, you know, 2018, 2019, it was like, you know, the question was, are these characteristics still true? And it's like, we call them invariants, so it better be true. And the interesting thing was that they largely are true, although some of them are a little more threatened in the current reality than they were even 7 years earlier. But an important step here is that when people, particularly policymakers, talk about the internet today, they're not really thinking about, you know, the IP layer and the networks of networks. They're really thinking, you know, all the services that we use that run on top of the internet. Those were never built with those characteristics, right? And that's okay, because, you know, they weren't meant to be. However, you know, that's where we get this disconnect, where you expect the internet to be this generative platform for innovation and all kinds of good things, and you're thinking about something that's actually different. You're thinking about these applications and services in corporate reality. So it's kind of an important part of the 2019 work was really to understand that, you know, we're not really talking about the same thing anymore.
Yeah, I want to get back to that, because one of the things that you guys mentioned earlier, and Maria, you said, was about the weaponization of some of the areas that are vulnerable because of our interdependence. There's a whole commercial aspect to it as well. I mean, think about companies like Facebook, right, which is an American company, but multinational, and they have such a big impact because they collect data from citizens all over the world. And in a way that was weaponized with the Cambridge Analytica. And even for the Brexit debate in the UK, they found out later that Russian trolls were trying to change the debate to be more pro-Brexit on this platform. We still have that today in social media. Because of the consolidation, because of the power that is really invested in these companies. And that's different than what it was back in the day, where globalization and interdependence was seen as a benefit.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's actually an American political anthropologist called James C. Scott, who is really, really useful on this stuff. He's not written about the internet, but his ideas are incredibly multi-application. So he wrote a book called Seeing Like the State well over a decade ago by now. And it's basically, it explains a lot about why the internet is so generative, you know, why as a platform it's just much bigger than the sum of its parts. And also I think it gives us some guidelines as to why some of the current developments on the internet are potentially damaging. So let me just go back a bit to explain a bit about this book. He covers a lot of ground in it, but the best thing is to tell the story of German scientific forestry. And James C. Scott basically describes how in the late 19th century in Germany, obviously forestry was a huge, huge business, you know, felling trees, getting timber, using it to build stuff. And forests were, you know, these big complex ecosystems with lots of things in them that were not trees. And surely it was thought the most efficient and effective way to grow trees would be to just grow trees and not to deal with any of the other scrub or the other, you know, animals or the other species that were kind of, you know, getting into trees and making them rotten or having diseases, all of that stuff. And surely you would just want to grow the species of tree that was the best for timber. And so, it came to pass. So they planted forests that were, you know, very regular, that had trees that grew in rows. So they were much easier to harvest, that were monocultural, so, you know, single species trees. So you didn't have any of the kind of brushwood and nonsense that was getting in your way and eating up resources. And all was well. I mean, yields were just off the charts for decades, you know, absolute decades. And so this went well for a really long time. And clearly, you know, the idea of nature is fine, but humans are much better at organizing things and bringing them down to essentials, you know, in order to maximize yields. So you know where this story is going. At some point, yields just collapsed. I mean, just fell off the cliff, you know, and why? Because, you know, monoculture is much more prone to disease. So trees are getting diseases. You didn't have kind of the way we understand much better now, even since that book has been published, about how trees and forests basically kind of sort of communicate and have kind of a much more complex system of support and interaction, you know, through fungal networks, etc. Long story short, basically the idea that let's just cut to the chase and have a really, really simple system. In fact, not a system at all. Let's just take the bit that we want. Let's just eat the cream on the cake and get rid of the rest of the cake. Turned out to be a terrible idea, and forestry collapsed. That was scientific forestry. James C. Scott says it's kind of a symptom of something that he calls high modernism. And actually, his book is called Seeing Like a State, Why, how does it go? Why Certain Schemes to Improve the Human Condition Have Failed.
That's a great leap forward by the Chinese.
It's exactly, yeah. Collectivization of agriculture, villagization in Tanzania, even stuff like, you know, let's build a new capital city in the jungle where it will have a grid system and all of the cleaners will live far away. We won't have kind of the messy people that live in the city. We'll just have a really beautiful capital city. I don't know if you've ever been to Brasilia. I have. It's a nightmare to get around, and it's actually a dead, unpleasant city. And if you ever try and walk from one ministry to the other along this vast kind of boulevard of that's laid out like an aeroplane, it's supposed to be beautiful and imposing. In 100 degree weather, going but from one ministry to another in your high heels, to walk, too short to hail a cab, it's a nightmare of a city. And of course, it's a planned city, like kind of the, you know, the French architect Corbusier, who said, you know, cities that emerge are all just kind of messy and they have little, you know, pathways that don't seem to make sense. And we need to organize things into a grid system and all would be well. So like, anyway, so that's kind of the James C. Scott thing is, you know, first, that's a really bad idea. And history has, gives us many examples. But secondly, he says, There are forms of knowledge that are inherent in complex emergent systems. And though that knowledge cannot be simplified very easily and cannot be commodified all that well. And so if you, so he calls, he says there are two different kinds of knowledge. One is metis, M-E-T-I-S. It comes from a Greek word and it basically means kind of local knowledge or practical knowledge. And that's the knowledge that just comes out of a system. So one really lovely example he gives, how does it go? He says, when Europeans first moved to the present day United States and they wanted to grow crops, and the Native Americans said to them, prime example of techne, they said, plant corn when the oak leaves are the size of a squirrel's ear. And like, that's like a sentence that has maybe 10 words in it. And but like that sentence, when you unpack it, it just, there's so much knowledge in there about seasons, about the sequence of crops, about when to plant things, about, you know,
centuries of knowledge condensed.
Yeah. So you just unpack it. So like, so, and the reason I'm kind of going deep on this stuff is because he also talks about techne, which is a form of kind of formal knowledge where you kind of deduce things from first principles. You organize your knowledge in the way that it should be, if it were to be, you know, properly systematic and high modernism. And I just think this is such a great way to think about the internet, because when you look at the internet of the internet invariants, that is an emergent system. It's complex. We call it an ecosystem for a reason. You know, there's so much more to it than than meets the eye. And, you know, what I think lots of the things I see happening at the moment, be it, you know, consolidation of the internet stack by, you know, your Amazon Web Services, be it the new IP proposal from Huawei, there, you know, be it so many, you know, endless failed attempts by telecoms operators to systematize the internet into a vertical stack, all the better for them to kind of, basically increase revenues and power. It all comes not just from, you know, the self-interest of let's make this thing simple and make money from it, or let's make it a vertical stack that kind of is pleasing to the eye. But I think it also comes from kind of some kind of deep human need to make systematic things that are emergent and to strip away what we think of as the non-essentials, but actually it turns out are the things that sustain life. Mm. And so, you know, when I read the internet invariants, it just seems to me such a good example of these are really good ways to describe the emergent properties of a network that is richer and deeper and bigger than the people who made it, than any of us who use it. But that also has within it the seeds of constant change. You know, I mean, the internet as the internet, rather than kind of these kind of vertical silos and stacks, is it doesn't have an immune response to innovation and to change. In fact, that's kind of part of what makes it what it is. So I think there's something here about trying to, every time humans try to make something simple or systematic, we don't even know what we don't know, and we miss the good stuff. So I love the internet invariants because I think it kind of makes Leslie a bit of a, I know you're going to cringe when I hear this, but like, you're like the Jane Jacobs of the internet. You know, the one that says this thing needs to be messy and complex and a bit smelly and noisy and slightly rude. And
but it does.
Rich. Yeah.
No, anyway, it does. Right back to the forestry example, right? I mean, you can sum that up by saying that we are learning, or we should have learned by now, diversity is important, right? I mean, diversity in everything is actually important. I think that there's a lot in our society where, particularly those of us living in, you know, in North America and Europe, where we, you know, we live in our little houses, and lately we've done a lot more living in our little houses, and sort of think that we control our world, and we really don't, right?
I wonder how much of it is really more a human thing, to both human and governmental, to try and impose systems, to try and impose and see order where there might not be any.
Well, I think it's that, but it's also that we think we can, right? We think mm-hmm. that we actually understand mm-hmm. enough, and we don't. We clearly don't.
And by interfering, we basically destroy the one good, the things that are good about it.
Right. And this is not just idealistic blah, blah, right? I mean, I think we've heard before the example of when there was essentially one implementation, you know, when Bind was the DNS implementation, software implementation, yeah. right? And all the root servers ran it. This is a problem because it means that if you're all running the same software, that's not diverse enough.
Single
if you have one bug in it, if you have one critical exposure in it, you can take the whole system down, right? So Bind is not the only software run at the root servers anymore. So, you know, those are sort of the concrete realities of it. We haven't really even touched on nationalization of networks. But maybe we can sort of
assume. Let me make the link. Like, I think there's a really good example of this, which is say that the Russian sovereign internet law. You know, I've been looking a bit in more detail now that better translations are available into how it actually works. And one really key part of it is allowing the government to reach right into IXPs, internet exchange points, to reroute traffic. At key moments, and it has provisions in it that if there is some kind of very vaguely defined crisis, that Roscommon or the communications regulator is able to already has black boxes installed in IXPs, and somehow magically tech people can tell me how the regulator is able to intervene to reroute traffic, and obviously, that's a bad thing for lots of reasons. But in this sort of James C. Scott universe, I think it's a bad thing because what it shows you is that, you know, an IXP is making lots of traffic and routing decisions, like moment by day by day, moment by moment, and you know they know
IXP being Internet Exchange Point.
Internet Exchange Point, yeah. Like, you know, they know good routing paths, they know bad operators, they know, you know, there's a lot of kind of really informal knowledge that is encapsulated in those systems and in the people that run them. And when you, and basically, so if you say, right, well, the telecoms regulator is going to grab hold of all of that and do it according to some sort of centralized knowledge and centralized criteria for how it should go, you're going to make terrible decisions about, you know, that really damage routing at the local level, because those kind of routing decisions have to be made at the local level. Like, that's where they're useful and good. And so centralizing that kind of decision making is really poor, because you lose all of the kind of the practical local knowledge about how stuff should be.
So far we've really talked about how imposing a more of a hierarchical control model top down on something that is much more of an ecosystem that really understands more of a holistic approach has somewhat disastrous consequences. We talked earlier a bit about permissionless innovation, and I'm going to play the devil's advocate for a bit. So innovators really have had two models to deal with. One was to seek permission from public authorities before they could deploy or use or commercialize new devices or services. They could also just invent and sort of let the market determine. A prime example of the first one of a permissionless innovation is, you know, the World Wide Web. However, you know, one could argue that some of the biggest technical innovations were really funded by government R&D, at least certainly in the United States. So U.S. Department of Defense's funding in 1969 of ARPANET was the precursor to the internet. So that was an example of top-down sort of centralized decision-making. So in terms of fostering innovation, which one is better? Are we really looking at sort of a choice of polar opposites, or is there something in between?
Yeah, so the idea of kind of over centralizing information and trying to simplify, you know, beyond really to abstract and simplify and commodify control is not something that actually is a state versus private sector thing. I think we see it in the private sector as well. So the kind of argument that, well, DARPANET was publicly funded, therefore the internet is kind of a state thing as well, is not massively adjacent to the criticism. Really, here is that whether you are, you know, the Communist Party of China or Huawei, you know, fronting for it and saying we want to have, you know, do new IP, which is kind of a whole top-down reorganization of the internet to reduce the autonomy of the edges and to really centralize control. You know, is that public sector? Is that private sector? Neither. It's basically part of a totalizing mentality that wants to organize and make things rigid and hierarchical and gather information and gather control. It's the same mentality personally that I've seen every time I've seen a management consultant go into an organization and say, hey, we can make your organization, you know, better, more efficient. And what do? They always try and strip the information out of the jobs. So you take the autonomy and the intelligence out of, say, people working on the shop floor and centralize it in a management and information system and say, look, we saved you a bunch of money because now you can hire people at minimum wage to do a job which previously they had some kind of intelligence, they had some kind of tech, you know, some Métis, some kind of local intelligence. Like it's the same kind of totalizing mentality in Taylorism, you know, in kind of scientific management.
It's is that a human trait, though, this totalizing mentality? Is it a sort of something that we default to as humans, wanting to see order?
Having gone to a convent boarding school, I have to say that I think it's probably fundamental to some humans. But I think in the 20th century, we have made an absolute ideology and a religion of totalizing institutions, be they public or private sector, that rip the marrow out of life and try and control things and make life much more difficult for all of us.
From industrialization onwards, really, you know, from when we started thinking it was better to have a factory with, you know, with machines, it could do things so much quicker, better, faster.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, machines can be great. I think, you know, it's not that, I mean, I'm not talking about kind of, you know, being a Luddite. I mean, we're all doing this stuff because we love technology, right? We're all here, but it's more, you know, why does it so often seem to be accompanied by these mental models of command and control? Like, what is that? Mm-hmm. You know, if the internet wasn't invented, wasn't here already, we could not invent it.
So, wow. So we're getting to the point where we're going to need to wrap up. And as Alexa knows, I like to go out on a more of a high note.
But
so where can we go from here?
Yeah, I mean, we've gone from globalization, right? Where we said early on, internet was developed at a time when everybody believed in globalization, sort of multi-stakeholder model, collaboration. Now we see these times of totalism models, you know, isolationist, Brexit. Is this inevitable? Is there something we could do to prevent some of these consequences, the harsher consequences?
Absolutely. So one of the things that James C. Scott says is that, you know, this kind of high modernism, these totalizing phenomena happen when there is no wealth of civil society to resist. So, you know, it is really hard to suck people into kind of a system if they're well bonded, if they have got good organization, good resistance. Humans can always, you know, do better. But I think for us in tech, I think there are a couple of things we need to realize. And one is, you know, the telcos are always going to be wanting to get back in the loop and to get back in control. And I know this isn't for everybody, you know, to agree with necessarily, but telcos are fighting a losing battle. The internet is a utility. Traffic is a utility. And the constant, you know, dying wasp efforts of telcos to grab back control, to grab back, you know, value-added services is absolutely, you know, it's incredibly damaging to the internet. So much of what we're seeing happening at the moment is this unholy alliance of telecoms operators and autocratic states, you know, working hand in hand, be it in the ITU or elsewhere, to say, look, you know, I'm an operator, I want control of this thing, I want to up my revenues, I don't want these tech guys, you know, taking my revenues away. You're a government, you're not, you know, semi-autocratic or just a little bit nervous government who wants to have lots of choke points and, you know, a permission-based network. Let's work together because we both want effectively the same thing. But then when you look at, you know, people like us who are kind of the internet, internet co-religionists, let's say, internet essentialists and, you know, and who's on the other side of that fight? Well, it's big tech, which has its own form of, you know, totalizing mindset that is trying to, you know, do you want to be part of the Huawei Borg or do you want to be part of the Google Borg? Like it's not all that different. So I think we really have to accept that data is a utility and, you know, we do not have to spend more cycles trying to find a way for telecoms operators to feel happier about the fact that they are a commodity provider. And that is what happens in a mature market. It's a commodity. It's a low, you know, it's a low value added business. That's what it is. I mean, put it this way, you know, electricity is exactly the same kind of utility or commodity as the internet is. And yet I don't, you know, I don't allow my electricity provider to have a point of view about, you know, what kind of washing machine I buy. You know, I don't allow my electricity provider to have a point of view about when I use a hot water for my shower. Like, they don't get to reach into my life and have kind of value added, you know, fingers all over how my household runs.
You're talking about
actually,
telcos.
Actually, in some places they do.
Yeah.
They do exactly that.
And you know how they're doing it? Via the Internet of Things. So,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So this idea that basically commodity providers should have some kind of value-added relationship with me, it's nonsense. And we don't have to keep kind of, you know, giving lip service to the idea that telcos need to do anything more than provide basic service and let us...
Maria, was that the idea behind, for example, some of the mobile providers and having these walled gardens where they dictated what kind of handset you could have, they dictated what kind of content that you would have, and that you couldn't leave their walled garden without any kind of, you know, contractual provisions that you had to pay and so forth. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's just kind of the understanding that innovation is not something that can be left to large companies to basically control the choke points to. And, you know, they are trying to remake the internet in the image of a much more vertically integrated stack where, you know, it's permission based, it's all of the things that is, you know, it's not a general purpose network, it's a specialized service network, all of the things that the internet invariants are not. And I think, you know, in order to make the world safe for the internet invariants and keep innovation open for future generations, I think we have to accept that, you know, some of the power struggles that have been going on for four decades now, you know, give it up. Like, the internet has to be able to generate innovation. Like, I look on it really similarly to, you know, a lot of us are worried about democracy and is democracy going to survive? We don't know, but we know that I think democracy is very similar to the internet. It's a complex system. It's much more than just voting, you know, and each of us has to do everything within our power to make sure that it survives onto the next generation. Like, we're not going to win this fight ourselves. We're not going to win the internet, but our job is to keep the internet sufficiently open so that future people can innovate, so that we don't lock in these permanent favorites, you know, so that we don't lock in current business models. That's our job.
And like democracy, it really does rely on having informed individuals.
Yeah. It does. And constantly creating breathing space for people to do, you know, to do their work, constantly fighting every effort to centralize and control and shut it down. The totalizing mindset is everywhere. You know, the internet won once, but it has to win every time.
Hallelujah. Thank you, Maria. This was wonderful.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.